This is The Nature of Hosting, a podcast series about the ways we gather and the difference that inspired hosting can make in our lives and communities. I'm Susan Spakowski.
I'm Amanda Bostland.
And I'm Mark Coffin. For the past few months, we've been having conversations with hosts and facilitators across Nova Scotia to find out what they're learning about hosting. In these episodes, we are sharing a bit of what we heard, and Susan and Amanda are offering some of their own reflections. You can hear the complete conversations and learn more about the people we spoke with over at howwethrive.org. There, you will also find many useful and inspiring resources. We'd also like to acknowledge that all of our conversations, including the one we're about to have, took place on the unceded, unsurrendered territory of the Mi'kmaq. So this episode is called Fire, Holding the Circle. Susan, can you tell us where this theme comes from?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the campfire and just sitting in a circle around the fire in the dark and listening to stories and good company, that feeling of warmth and comfort. But fire can also be dangerous, and I'm thinking of the fires in the West right now that are burning out of control. And just those images in the news are very disturbing because they remind us that our world is on fire. So I think these two images are actually connected. Because our world is in trouble, it seems more important than ever to come together and create spaces where it's okay to be real, and a space where we can hold the loss and the anxiety as well as the warmth and comfort of good company. So in this podcast, we'll hear both of those perspectives, both the safety and the warmth of the tended fire, and also what it takes to host the heat of difficult conversations that feel uncomfortable or even out of control. Hmm.
So whose voice will we hear first?
Well, in episode one, Shalyn Jodry began to tell the story of how she and her partner, Frank Muse, hosted a group of 60 people for several days in the forest at Bear River First Nation. In this episode, Shalyn continues to share that story, describing what happens when the guests are invited into the wigwam for their first gathering.
That they've heard, that they know. And so I usher, you know, the last of everybody up to the wigwam. And when I do that, I know that the wigwam is holding so much energy and strength itself. I know that those poles that people had prepared to put up the wigwam, I know that the benches that were put together by Frank or his friends and family, that fire pit that has been there for years, that everything holds this special energy that just as soon as Frank and I go in and there's all this group of people chattering about and finding a seat, that I know what Frank means by that the pressure's off of us, that this place will take care of so much for people, that this place itself and the sounds outside and the light, the way that the light comes through the canvas is so gorgeous, that is part of what feels welcoming and awe-striking. And sometimes you can see the shadows of the leaves, you know, through the canvas, and you know that those trees are out there taking care, you know, and just like blankets, you know, but yet that you're so close to nature, and how that really speaks to the heart and soul of humanity, of what it means to be a human creature of the earth. And when you're sitting somewhere that you feel comfortable and protected, like under the skirt of this canvas, but yet you know the trees are just outside, that you're that close to nature, you can hear the peepers down the trail in the pond singing, or sometimes you can hear a raven far off, you know, that you know that you're that close to nature, that the power of nature to speak to us as humans is there. And we don't have to mention it. We don't have to say it. We don't have to point it out. We don't have to lecture about it. Is that it's just there being gorgeous for people. And we just have to make sure that, you know, we've called them all in and that we know when it's time to start, and that we offer and we explain what the smudge is about, you know, that we make sure that the wood keeps going on the fire. But the fire is doing the work itself. We just have to feed it, you know, and the smudge is doing the work itself. We just have to light it and make sure that enough has gone around. And And so we do feel a little bit of responsibility to make sure, you know, that you're watching everybody, making sure everybody is comfortable. And is there somebody who needs a more comfortable seat or chair? You know, is everybody close enough to the fire? You know, that you look out for these things, but those feel minor in this moment. You just feel the magic of the place.
That was Shalyn Jodry talking about hosting a circle around the fire at the Bear River First Nation with Frank Muse. Susan, can you introduce our next clip?
Yeah, I'd like to bring back two voices that we heard in earlier episodes, and they're both talking about the role of stories, which somehow goes along with this image of sitting around the fire and taking the time to really get to know each other. So in the first clip, we'll hear Mi'kmaq Elder Albert Marshall from Eskasoni.
Relationships. For me, I have to remind myself, the fundamental principle of any relationship is through the exchange of stories. Because it's through this exchange of stories that we will both know who we are, where we come from, and why we are here. And as this relationship is unfolding and working, we will then begin to work together and see and look at the other W. Where are we going? And that will determine us by knowing about each other, where our strengths and weaknesses are, where our responsibilities are, and work on those responsibilities as to how to work together, how to learn together, how to help each other, and most importantly, how to use the gifts that we have been given to help those that are in need, especially the ones that cannot represent themselves in human form.
And now we'll hear from Toria Adu, who brings African stories, drumming, and culture into Halifax schools.
I know that identity comes from the stories you're told about who you are, your ancestors are, and all those stories, and they pile up in you and help you to build those blocks. So if you don't have that, you're just going on with someone else's. There's always a disconnect. And I find that's part of it that is not connecting with the a lot of our Black children in the system. And that's why I like the drumming. Mm. And it's not just that I'm drumming. As we're drumming, I'm telling stories and inviting stories. So everybody loves to hear stories. And so they're building on those. And what better stories to tell than your own life? You can't go wrong with that one. No one can tell you you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. It's your own life. You made your mistakes and you learned your lessons, and that's your life. And as they get to know you, that there's that trust also that builds, and it helps affirm them to know who they are, you know. And but it's a journey. Mm-hmm. You know, I've crossed the lines. I have very good friends who are of European descent, and we talk deep, you know. And so, but it's taken years to build that level of trust, mm-hmm. right? So I think trust also has a part to play in all of this, because when you share of yourself, you hope that it doesn't get misinterpreted or used for the wrong reason. Yeah, so there's a lot of, it's a risk you take, and I think you won't lose anything from sharing of yourself. Then you build someone else up. Yeah.
So that was Elder Albert Marshall and Toria Adu talking about sharing stories as a way of getting to know each other.
Now we're going to shift a bit from the warmth of connection to what can happen when groups get a little too comfortable and how disagreement, difference, and heat aren't always such a bad thing. So this is Brooke Thorndycraft coming back. You might remember that she talked to us in the previous episode about her work as a facilitator and how she uses body-based approaches to help groups work through stress and trauma. In this clip, she goes a little further. The goal isn't just safety, but it's about being safe enough to be able to include sparks of disagreement and even conflict.
I think I absolutely agree that connection and relationship has to be built for things to feel safe enough for people to be honest about difference, to be honest about even just, and to be honest, even just about, you know, like, oh, I disagree, or this isn't how I want to, or, you know, I'm thinking about like groups that I've been in that are very kind and gentle and supportive and caring, and there's deep relationships, and everyone is a little bit afraid to challenge each other. Everyone's a little bit afraid to break the kind, caring feeling of it. And that can be another way that safety, or I mean, I don't even necessarily want to use that word. Like, I feel like that can be, that's actually a disconnection in trying to stay in connection, in trying to be in relationship. It can marginalize the parts of ourselves or the parts of the group that are not feeling the connection in that moment, or are wanting to name something that doesn't feel good in that moment, because there's a fear of a loss of belonging. It's like, here we have this beautiful group. It feels like it's supportive and caring. And if I mention that someone said something that hurt me, or if I mention that I don't like the direction that we're going in with this conversation, am I going to lose access to this feeling of care? And feelings of care, I think, are very rare for us in our lives, right? And like, I think about it even, you know, from sort of like a trauma therapy kind of perspective, and the way that, you know, a therapist, if there's a rupture in a relationship, there's a huge amount of work and effort that goes into rebuilding that relationship. And that's because most of us don't experience relationships where we can cause a rupture and then have that relationship continue in the same kind of way with the same level of support. But I actually really love a good disagreement where everyone actually feels like it's okay to not agree, and that it's okay to sometimes be forceful about that. And not, you know, by forceful, I don't mean like dominating or shutting down, but emphatic or excited or convinced, and where that sort of feeling of like, I disagree with you and I'm open to you convincing me differently, but you have to hear about why I disagree with you first, right? And like, and I think there is a piece, when I said at the beginning that I don't feel, that I actually rarely feel fully comfortable in groups, I think part of it is that I, as a facilitator, have learned to really tone that part of myself down. But I can be really like argumentative. And that's actually like, if I was really authentically being myself, there would be some argumentativeness in how I was interacting in a group. And I think like, that's also a piece of human reality and experience that is totally awesome and like worth fostering and supporting, that actually it's okay for us to disagree, and to disagree like strongly. And that doesn't actually mean That doesn't mean that I don't care about you. It doesn't mean that I don't care what you have to say. It's just that I feel really passionately about what I'm trying to say. And I feel like I need to be very clear and like strong about that. And it's like, how do we actually welcome and embrace the wide range of human ways of expression and ways of being and experiences and figure out how to do that in a way that removes some of the more traumatic elements? Like, I'm not suggesting sort of condoning, bullying behavior or like those kinds of things, but actually just recognizing that like, even like culturally, you know, like my mom's side of the family is very, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. And my dad's side of the family is very, if you're not arguing loudly, it's because you don't care. And how do you support spaces where that can coexist? And that would be my wildest dreams, would be that those two sides of my family could actually coexist. And everything that represents.
So that was Brooke Thornycraft adding some sparks to the fire.
I'd like to bring in Madonna Doucette. Here she's talking about having difficult conversations with youth she works with in Cape Breton. In her job, she invites young people to explore gender identity issues, amongst other things. In this clip, she offers some insights that might be useful to adults.
Listening is actually everything, is asking some good, you know, open-ended questions. I think that if, you know, if we were talking about parent-child kind of relationships, that children would be very impressed if an adult in their life asked them, how are you feeling about the 215 children? Or how has pandemic affected you? Or I heard that your friend can't see their grandmother in the long-term care home because of restrictions. How are you feeling about that? You talk to each other, just like giving them more credit than we tend to. And actually listening to their answers. I feel that this is just a sort of an overall sort of observation, but adults are too busy around their children, and that eye contact and listening are game changers and sound so simple, but are absent from a lot of our conversations. I think maybe also a very timely piece of advice is, if you're having a conversation with anyone, put your phone down. Don't divide your attention. Give them full attention. It is such a game changer for that child's life. I think it's great to tell the children that you don't know the answer and to look for information together. I think it's really important for us to like demystify this all-knowing adult image, because we really are all making it up as we go. So let's call the wizard out right away on that one. And I have a catchphrase, which my children make fun of me, but they now say it as well, which is, people can be more than one thing. And I feel like that sentence actually really helps me through life more than maybe any other information. People can be more than one thing. A person can be awful to you and great to many, many people. A person can be thoughtful and ignorant at the same time. Like, we make mistakes, but we're not our mistakes. And that I am a bit of a Pollyanna. I do believe that people are capable of learning and changing, and that's another reason why we have to allow the space for people can be more than one thing, but because people can change. When I am doing work in communities, I'm very intentional with my eye contact. I try to have like moments with everyone, you know, and I will often make the observation, if I'm in a classroom, and what usually happens is the boys will speak and the girls won't. A lot of girls have had trauma. That's just an unfortunate fact. At a young age, a lot of girls have already experienced some trauma. And so I will often stop my presentation and just like speak directly to the girls in the classroom. And I'll say, you know what, you have such important things to say. I want you to know that I want to hear what you have to say. Mm-hmm. So find your voice, because your voice is important. And then I'll go back and just keep talking. And then I'll see that those people that were being very quiet will rally their themselves and connect more often. So I feel like that's important too, is giving an extra hand and building extra space for those people who can't carve it out themselves.
So that was Madonna Doucette, who is education coordinator for the Youth Project in Cape Breton and an advocate for women's rights, gender equality, the LGBTQ community, and child poverty.
So next we have Basha Solars. I wanted to bring her in here because she has so much training and theoretical understanding and practice working with conflict. She's actually been at it professionally for 25 years, and yet she also has a way of just trusting people's innate ability and common sense and resilience. She's worked in all kinds of contexts, most recently in the Nova Scotia healthcare system.
I'm thinking of the story of a nurse who came to see me for coaching. And what brought her through the door was, I think I could sort of sum it up in this one moment where I asked her, you know, of all the things you're struggling with right now at work, what's the hardest part of all of it for you? And she said, I don't like who I've become. And she talked more about the thoughts and feelings she was having and how that even showed up in her behavior with other people and even toward herself. And it really brought home for me something that Joe Folger and Brooke Bush have written about. They created this model that I'm trained in to move through conflict called the transformative model. And they say that, you know, people facing a conflict really, they care about the interests that they want to pursue or the right that needs to be honored or the need that needs to be satisfied. All those things are truly important to people. And at the same time, the thing that seems to trouble us most in conflict is how we end up treating ourselves and other people. Like we find ourselves feeling uncomfortable, even repelled by what we're doing to ourselves and other people, our thoughts, our feelings, our behavior. And that's often why I think we avoid conflict and we avoid those conversations, because it's just so profoundly uncomfortable on some level. And it takes us sometimes to places that we don't even want to go, really. And so I think that's, first of all, kind of at the heart of what challenges a lot of people in a conflict. And for this nurse, what the real pain in that moment for her was that when she was still in nursing school, she really envisioned herself becoming a leader in nursing, like someone who would really be at the front helping other people do their best work. And she found herself in a situation that was, as we see a lot in healthcare, it was under-resourced in terms of people and materials and time and all sorts of things. And out of her frustration and her team's frustration, she found herself joining in all the negative talk and the kind of thing that she hated when she got into nursing and observed and swore she would never do. And she was going to turn that around. And here she was taking part in it. And so when she said, I hate who I've become, it was the last thing on earth she wanted to be, right? And that's why she came to coaching. Like, can I turn this around? And if I can, how do I do that? Because I can't do this anymore. I think what I really love about this approach is the acknowledgement that, sure, you can get to yes. You know, William Ury wrote his book based on the Harvard Negotiation Project about getting to win-win and negotiation. And that's great. And I'm all for it. And I absolutely support that if that's what people are looking for. And at the same time, I think individuals and groups can have those things where, you know, they're not going to agree. They're not going to have seeming resolution. But can we learn to live with this difference? I think that's what the transformative model offers that I find so brilliant is, I may not agree with you, Susan, on a given thing. You know, we may not agree on how to do this or what, you know, what we should do here or something. But maybe there's more clarity about my position, your position. Maybe there's more understanding, even if there's not agreement. And so that in itself is transformative, right? So learning to live with difference, I think, is just as important for people, sometimes even more so. Overall, the idea is just to start by listening and asking and not assuming you know what people need. Mm-hmm. And assuming that they do. or at least they're in a better position to know it than I am in that moment. There's something about holding a view of people as innately capable that helps you remember that whatever kind of frustration and difficulty and struggle people are having in their conflicts, that doesn't define who they are. Like that nurse who came into my office, the fact that she was engaging in behaviors that she didn't even have respect for, that didn't define who she was. I was not going to limit her to that. And so to be able to see people as bigger than they sometimes imagine themselves to be in that moment, I think is helpful, because that's the frame that you're holding and in which you know, that you hold that conversation with. And I think that has impact. I think of, you know, Bill O'Brien saying that the quality, you know, the internal state of the intervener has impact on the intervention, right? So the quality of your internal state impacts what happens in whatever it is you're doing. And so to be holding that view, that belief of people, I think does have impact. You have what you need. You're not defined by whatever limitations this struggle offers you. And I know that to be true. So it's kind of like being able to have the big view, the long view of people. And I think when you have that, you're able to really be centered and kind of hold your seat in the middle of that kind of conversation, as we say, you know, sort of sit in the fire of people's distress and their temporary destabilized kind of condition, and know that that is just temporary. And as well, giving, you know, holding space for a conversation often does give people an opportunity to articulate what matters to them. And when that happens, people can kind of raise their gaze a bit and notice that the other person may have some things that matter to them too.
So that was Basha Solars talking about hosting challenging conversations.
Before we move into reflection, I would like to bring back Sylvia Paris, as she shares a personal strategy for dealing with conflict, something that she learned from her family.
When I'm in discussions that feel conflictual or, you know, in reality maybe are or whatever, I imagine holding hands, and I imagine holding hands until we get through this, right? And sometimes, I mean, I've said that out loud in some spaces, but I use it a lot inside my mind when I'm setting somewhere and just trying to, like, let me, like, be mindful here. Let me think about what's being said. Let me understand, like, all those things we kind of process with ourselves. But this kind of imagining holding hands, because we used to do that a lot with my children, when we were younger children, and we were, like, you know, getting through something, we would come and sit and have to hold hands while we're talking it through.
That was Sylvia Paris talking about how she navigates conflict. So what has listening to some of these voices sparked for you two?
Well, just right off that image of holding hands, I think I'm going to take that with me for a long time when I'm mad at somebody and either literally or in my imagination holding hands. I mean, that it would be very hard to get very righteous, I think, in that kind of situation. So I just, for me, that sparks, I guess, an appreciation for one of the themes in this episode about trusting that knowledge and that ability that we already have, whether from our family and culture or whether from just having the courage to step in, even if you don't have all the answers. And at the same time, I'm also hearing that it can be such a gift to have somebody come in and give you some support to take a step that's really difficult, or to help you see that you're more than who you thought you were in a particular moment, like the story of the nurse, you know, when she didn't like who she'd become. To have somebody kind of move alongside with you and see you as more than that person that you didn't like. So that balance between trusting our intuition, our instincts, our the knowledge we already have, but then also an appreciation for the role that somebody can play as a host or a facilitator, and also the tools that they bring and the training that they've done. Yeah, both seem to be important. So that's one thing that struck me.
When you started off talking about hearing Sylvia talk about the holding hands and having that in your mind in order to help you through a conflict, and that you sharing that and how it moved you is like a concrete example of the power of stories, too. How when we share heartfelt stories with one another, then, you know, there's all this potential for, of course, learning from each other and then being able to take that into our lives and all becoming more effective humans. And then, yeah, in that part too, that idea of, well, I think Madonna said the words were people can be more than one thing. And then another kind of balance there would be, like, if you imagine people are all these different, like we're each all these different identities, of course, or have all these different components to ourselves. And it's easy to like look at one another and forget that we're not just the one thing that we assume of each other or that we've noticed in the role that we have the most familiarity with and such. But if you kind of bring the idea of the balance, the metaphor of the fire into that idea too, that we can all potentially hold like the warmth and comfort of the fire and the explosiveness and the danger and the heat of the fire. That if we learn to see both sides, or hopefully even go beyond the idea of sides, but see that diversity in one another, how helpful that could be.
Yes, and if it's almost that they are dependent on each other, because if you don't include, if you are shying away from conflict and not including all of those voices in yourself or in other people that are uncomfortable to hear, then it is hard to go to a deeper sense of connection and warmth and, you know, genuine kind of robustness about a group or a meeting. So again, it comes back to that idea around resilience. There's all these different aspects to it. But being able to move through conflict, or and as Basha was saying, not even necessarily to get to agreement, but just even to include it, just to include the differences in a bigger space. So I think that's another theme for me too, is the expanse of that expansive feeling of not shrinking down to a single identity or the way we see other people. But expanding to include more, be more, hold more. And that, you know, that's really part of the hosting role, I think, to create that hold that expansive space.
And this is also kind of now making me think of our theme of the forest, the diversity, the importance of diversity for a healthy ecosystem. So the differences within ourselves and the differences between calm and conflict, and then also what all of the different people bringing that, and then that overall that creates something healthy. And then also that Brooke was specifically talking about how smoothing over conflict can be, that can be dangerous too, like you were just saying, I guess, or reflecting on feeling the conflict is important. And if you just try to ignore it, then that's kind of like a smoldering kind of danger maybe underneath.
Embers. And back to what Shalom, the story that Shalom was talking about and being in the wigwam, one thing that stayed with me about that is this, the sense of when she said that she and Frank could let go and trust once all the people were in there and everything had been prepared, and there was a sense of the wigwam, the canvas, the trees around were all holding that space with them. And so something about how if you don't tune in to all those kind of environmental aspects of holding a space for a gathering, you can imagine that you feel, you're responsible for for everything that happens. And that sense of responsibility can be, feel like a burden. And it's also a bit inflated, you know, because it's almost as if you're the only one, as opposed to you're just one of this whole set of conditions that's come together, including the other people. So for me, that's just a reminder for myself, I think, about not to feel too responsible and to trust that sense of holding that's already there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like to hear Albert talking about that too, that everyone's bringing their own gifts. And that we can then trust that, if we can learn to trust that everyone's bringing their own gifts, and not just the people, but the environment itself, that we're all contributing gifts.
Yeah, and if you feel responsible to the point of having to leave a lot of yourself outside the room, then you're probably not going to be as good a host. If you can't bring your full experience in, or if you just feel like your role is to just manage every little detail, you know, which is, I can get into that.
Yeah.
it's like this fear of things are going to get out of control, you know, the fire is going to leave the fire pit, and it is, but at some point you've got to let go and trust.
You've been listening to The Nature of Hosting. The theme for this episode is fire, holding the circle.
We're going to close now by playing a 13-minute clip from a conversation that I had with Robert Seymour Wright and his colleague James Dubay. I wanted to hear what they had to say about trauma and its connection with dynamics that turn up in meetings and gatherings. And Robert and James had co-founded the People's Counseling Clinic, a pro bono mental health clinic in Halifax. And a lot of what they do involves people who've experienced a lot of trauma. I met Robert at the first How We Thrive gathering, and I have this vivid memory of this time when he was on a panel. And at one point, he just turned to the audience and said, "Listen, white people," and told it like it is. So in this clip, he talks about white trauma. And just a heads up that for white folks like the three of us, what he says could be a little uncomfortable to listen to. But we thought it was important to practice what we've been talking about in terms of holding the circle and staying present to voices that we need to hear.
So we invite you to listen in on what Robert and James have to share and what they've learned about working with trauma in the context of gatherings. Afterwards, we'll keep the fire burning for a little while, and we invite you to hang around quietly by the fire with us. We're not going to talk. It's just an invitation to take a few minutes to reflect on what we heard. Eventually, the fire will go out, and then you'll hear from us again in the next episode. Thanks for listening. And here they are in order of appearance, Robert Wright and James Dubay.
We work with people who tend to be hard to serve from a mental health point of view, people who have experiences with violence, both as victims and perpetrators, people who are street affected, people who suffer from substance abuse disorders, and people who are racialized and marginalized, queer folk. And we work in the area of sex and sexual behavior, and where trauma and abuse is kind of at the soul. I'd say we're priests in trauma.
You know, we work with a wide range of people who cause problems in our communities, and trauma is ubiquitous. So we've not worked with a social problem where we've not seen victims of trauma overrepresented. And that's something that is uncomfortable for people to talk about, but it's certainly our truth. It's our reality at the clinic. So, it's what the reason we focus on trauma so much is because it's in all of our clients. Mm. And that is what it is.
People in the dominant community, white people, let's be plain, white people, white middle-class people, are starting to see trauma as a part of what they have to deal with on a daily basis. And as we begin to talk about trauma, then Indigenous people are talking about intergenerational and trauma, you know, residential school survivor trauma. Black people are talking about multi-generational trauma. And they're talking about, you know, that trauma with a very particular name, you know, that post-traumatic slave syndrome, right? And so we're all starting to talk about trauma now, and we're all starting to see that our communities and our individual selves are compromised because of trauma. I remember realizing that we'd hit a watershed in this area when former students of some of the most famous day and residential schools in Europe were beginning to talk about the trauma and abuse that they suffered while in school. And historically, of course, and you know this, the stories, you know, if you even watch something like The Crown, and you know, these stories about people who become like the heads of industry and the heads of states of nations across the world go to these schools and are subjected to the most horrendous treatment, not only by their teachers, but by their upperclassmen. And it's almost like abuse is part of the culture, and it's supposed to make you a man of the world, a leader of men, this sort of thing. And that's been the case over the generations. I mean, Sir Isaac Newton taught it to these places, you know what I mean? So it's been around for a long time, this culture. And now we have people who are in their 30s, who are people of a new generation, who are seeing that the abuse really has affected their ability to show up properly in their families and in their communities, because the model of leadership that is kind of heartless and cruel is passé. And so suffering abuse as part of your education is no longer cool. And so as white people begin to experience that, it creates a lot of space for racialized people to put their trauma on the agenda and to say, hey, look, if that's true for you, how about slavery and 400 years of that? How about colonialism and, you know, 400 or 500 years of that? And so I think that we're beginning to recognize that some of the things that we had ascribed to people as their kind of community's dysfunction, we're now recognizing as the consequences of trauma, right? And so that makes us have to rethink how we feel about people when we recognize that the dysfunction that a people experience is not a function of their innate inferiority, but a function of the trauma that has been perpetrated on them by the very people who would judge them.
I think first you have to believe it's there, and you have to be willing to see it. And if you're, say, facilitating a meeting, you have to be willing to name it. I'm not so much a fan of trigger warnings and such, but naming trauma and making it clear to people that, yeah, there's trauma in the room and we're aware of it. Mm-hmm. Really big first step for people to feel safe, right?
It is about acknowledging the trauma in the room as we begin. We've all been to meetings where something happens and things in the community, the Black community, we say things pop off, right? So next thing you know, someone's shouting and someone's shouting back and people are angry. And there's this, well, clearly, that response is disproportionate to whatever was said in the meeting. So whatever was said in the meeting simply triggered a larger trauma. So if you go into those meeting settings aware that there is trauma, it's like entering a minefield. You have to let everybody know, hey, we're in a minefield. We're going to try to step lightly, But it's quite possible that we're going to step on a mine. And when we step on a mine, we're going to pause and we're going to acknowledge that some harm has been perpetrated. And we're going to try to collect ourselves and remind ourselves that though we may have triggered each other's trauma, it is not our intention to hurt each other here. Right? And I think we need to kind of double down on that kind of messaging. We need to let people know, hey, we can acknowledge that we have triggered your trauma, and in doing so, we have harmed you, but let us be reminded that we have determined not to purposely harm each other here. So let's pause and give space for that trauma. Let's have a support person who can take that person outside of the room if they need to debrief and collect themselves. Let us pause in the meeting so that we can remind each other of our commitment not to harm each other and to recognize the harm when it occurs. And then let's get on with the agenda. Now, that might not seem like a very efficient way to run a meeting, but it certainly will be a more humane way that has the potential of building community, right? Rather than penalize people in meetings for being disrupted and irrational. If we recognize that the disruption and what may appear to be irrational really comes out of this history of trauma, the presence of trauma in every room, I think we'd be better off. White privilege is just an artifact of history. But white supremacist acculturation, white fear, white guilt, white fragility, these are the things that are the evidence of white trauma, right? And sometimes people say, well, I don't understand white trauma. No, it can't be. Well, in the sex offender treatment world, we recognize that when a person perpetrates an offense against the other person, they are both traumatizing the person they abuse, and they are themselves traumatizing themselves by the perpetrating of abuse, right? And so both are trauma victims, right? Not to mention, of course, the fact that the person who perpetrated was probably perpetrated against somewhere else. There needs to be an understanding of the commonality of trauma, but white trauma needs to be processed, I think, over here without a lot of labor from Black and other marginalized folk. Well, I think you need to kind of understand this thing, this white privilege thing. So what I talk about is racism's effect on white and Black people. And so we've talked a lot about Black effects, the effects on BIPOC folk, historical legacy of underprivilege, right? Intergenerational trauma for Black folk, post-traumatic slave syndrome. But on white people, white privilege, of course, which is an artifact, much like the historical legacy of underprivilege, but this idea of a white supremacist acculturation, the absence of cultural competence, and then all of these things, white empathy, white guilt, white fear, white fragility, these are real. And I think that white people need to start to unpack those things and recognize that that's the evidence of their racial trauma. Why is it so hard to hear and to stay in a space where you're being accused of historical atrocities? Why are white people so angered, frustrated, ashamed, all the dramatic responses that they have, the rush to innocence, all that is a trauma response, right? The inability to simply patiently listen and kind of consider the possibility that you are a member of a group that has perpetrated atrocities on other peoples. The inability to not have a disproportionate emotional response to that space is a trauma response. And so white people need to practice in other spaces how to absorb the truth of their location in this historical dilemma and not show up, rushing to innocence, self-defending, even when white people kind of dissolve into weepy pools of shame and grief. That's not helpful either, but it's your trauma response. It's about coming to terms with, understanding, and processing your own trauma, but recognizing that your trauma has to take a secondary place to the trauma that the people who you victimized, and when I say you, I mean your class victimized against another class. And that takes a lot of strength and a lot of healing to be able to stay in that place and hear and not defend.